Thus, the North could conclude a peace treaty that would guarantee its sovereignty, while also attaining the aid necessary to revitalize its moribund economy and recommence feeding its people. In reporting on North Korea's development of nuclear weapons and its supposedly irrational hatred of the U.S., there is one fact that is constantly and universally omitted by the media: that the United States has been threatening the DPRK with nuclear annihilation for decades. Were this fact asserted by any of the hundreds of reporters regularly covering the issue, the North's recent development of nuclear weapons might not seem so irrationally aggressive after all. It is likely, however, that most of these reporters are themselves unaware of the fact. The brain-cleansing properties of propaganda operate, after all, in both directions. After the Korean War, the U.S. had nuclear warheads installed on the Korean Peninsula, in spite of the armistice agreement it had signed in 1953 that prohibited the introduction of such weapons. By the mid-1960s, writes Bruce Cummings, probably the sole American historian who has tried to understand and articulate the DPRK's point of view, South Korean defense strategy, engineered by the U.S., was pinned on routine plans to use nuclear weapons very early in any new war. Routinely, the U.S. would fly nuclear weapons near the DMZ in training exercises. The threat that one of these helicopters might accidentally stray over the DMZ and drop a bomb on Pyongyang was a constant fear. The nuclear weapons were only removed in 1991, after the Gulf War, when then-President George H.W. Bush decided to withdraw all tactical and battlefield nuclear weapons worldwide. This was understood as a conciliatory gesture by the North, since it was obvious that submarines bearing nukes could still arrive on its shores at any moment. What's more, the continual war game exercises conducted each year by U.S. and South Korean troops on the border, in plain view of North Korea, have, in Cummings' words, routinely included the introduction to Korea of nuclear-capable aircraft and naval ships of all types, backpack nukes controlled by mobile units, practice with nuclear cannons, and so on, with many South Korean units working together with the Americans on various nuclear war scenarios. In February 1993, the head of the U.S. Strategic Command announced that the Pentagon would be retargeting strategic nuclear weapons on North Korea. North Korea responded by announcing that it would be pulling out of the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, which states, among other things, that nations with nuclear weapons are not allowed to threaten those without them. It shot a medium-range Rodong-1 missile into the East Sea, the Sea of Japan, in May 1993, spurring a flurry of press reports that the crazed North Koreans were preparing to unleash atomic anarchy. To quell such concerns, the North Koreans proposed in June-July 1993 to replace their graphite reactor nuclear program, which Pyongyang had long claimed it had to use because no one was willing to help the country's poor power supply with nuclear energy, with U.S.-supplied light water reactors, which would simultaneously make Pyongyang dependent on outside fuel sources. Nothing came of this proposal. What, it is worth asking, did the DPRK want in return? Two essential things: for the U.S. to cease its threats and to work toward normalizing relations that would solidify a peaceful coexistence, eventually culminating in exchanges on the ambassadorial level. After a series of back-and-forth talks, shutdowns, provocations, and resumption of negotiations, the U.S. and DPRK finally arrived at a breakthrough that culminated in the 1994 October Framework Agreement. In return for the DPRK freezing its graphite reactors and returning to inspections under the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, the U.S. and a consortium of other nations would supply the DPRK with light water reactors as a means of solving its constant energy problems. Financial assistance, including phasing out sanctions against the North that had been in place since the Korean War, and a step-by-step development of diplomatic relations. Not long after this agreement was signed, control of the U.S. Congress shifted to the Republicans, who were categorically against it. Much foot-dragging and derailment of the U.S.'s commitments ensued. With the famine in full swing, many in the U.S. Congress privately grumbled that since the DPRK was bound to collapse at any moment, there was no point for the U.S. to fulfill its obligations. By May 1998, the first light water reactor had still not been constructed. Growing increasingly impatient, the North Koreans threatened that they would resume nuclear research if the U.S. did not fulfill its commitment. The following year, noting that economic sanctions still had not been lifted, the North once again made the same threat. Credibility is naturally lost when you appear to be lying or deceiving someone about your stated intentions. By the time George W. Bush became president, this loss of credibility was aggravated by a not-so-subtle strain of outright hostility, culminating in his second State of the Union address, given just months after the 9/11 attacks, in which he included North Korea in what he termed the Axis of Evil. The hardliners filling the Bush administration purposefully upturned anything the Clinton administration had sought to achieve in its foreign policy, pursuing a course of extreme isolationism that would mar the United States' reputation internationally for the next 8 years. North Korean diplomats complained that their new U.S. counterparts, such as Assistant Secretary of State James A. Kelly, were arrogant and evasive in their meetings. Relations between the two countries devolved into open hostility. The U.S. accused the North of harboring a uranium enrichment program. The North denied this and asked the U.S. to provide proof, such as satellite imagery. The U.S. failed to do so, and in all likelihood, this assertion was rooted in the same faulty intelligence that claimed Iraq possessed weapons of mass destruction. The DPRK then went further, proclaiming that although it did not currently have any nukes, as a sovereign nation, it had the right to possess nuclear weapons as a means of defense, just as the United States had for years. If a small child is bullied constantly by a teenager three times his size, it is somewhat counterintuitive to react with shock and surprise when that child one day shows up at school wielding a switchblade. In 2003, the DPRK officially withdrew from the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty. 2 years later, the country announced that it had developed its first nuclear weapons. This is a blade that the North has been openly carrying ever since. Americans have a troubled relationship with their own history. The truth often comes to us distorted via increasingly nebulous and questionable means of mediation. What we do learn, we tend to forget. That is, we tend to prefer to forget. Citizens of smaller, less powerful, impoverished nations are less likely to forget the lessons of history. Often those lessons are all they have. North Koreans, for certain, have not forgotten theirs. Putting aside the question of how these lessons are forced upon them and their own distorted means of transmission, the point is that this not forgetting forms the very essence of North Korean identity. There is the history of the Korean War, of course, which through the propaganda machinery is drummed into the brains of DPRK citizens on a daily, hourly basis. Today, there are in fact people still alive who can remember that war, who tell their children and grandchildren about what they experienced, the aerial bombardments that killed millions of civilians, the biological weapons that the United States deployed to sicken, disfigure, maim, and murder North Korean soldiers and innocent civilians. All the daily scenes of horror and carnage that no U.S. citizen has ever had to face directly. Then there is what we might call a history of the present, which reminds us that since 2005, the DPRK has been very open about its nuclear ambitions. That those ambitions are the direct result of another nuclear power, the United States, which has had nuclear weapons in its arsenal for decades, and is, in fact, the only country in the world to have used a nuclear weapon in warfare against another nation. A country not so far away from the Korean Peninsula. That those ambitions and their resultant implementation are, finally, the result of a foreign policy failure of the United States. The country that created North Korea when it drew that line across the 38th parallel in 1945, and has sought to destroy it ever since. The options that the young, inexperienced Kim Jong-un inherited when he came to power upon the death of his father in late 2011, ranged from bad to worse. Jong-un, age-wise, firmly entrenched in the Jongmadeng generation, but in terms of life experience, from a different world entirely. When the troubles began in 1994, both domestically, with the food shortage that would result in famine, and internationally, with the increasingly volatile relations with the United States, Kim Jong-il announced a new policy, Songun, or Military First, which elevated the North's own hardliners, the army, into the upper echelons of power. These are the men who are most satisfied with the status quo, who do not want things to change, and who have the arms and men at their disposal to make sure nothing will ever change. With Kim Jong-un's rise, some voices in the Western media cautiously expressed optimism that, given his youth and his early education in Switzerland, the young leader might make moves to open up his country, to cleanse its legacy of human rights abuses, to lighten its clampdown on dissent and close its notorious network of prison camps. The naivete behind such speculations is astounding. There is at least one good reason why the new leader did not undertake such radical measures. The military men surrounding him, his father's men, would never allow any such thing to take place. Had he even voiced such proposals out loud, he would have been deposed of, killed, immediately. Kim Jong-un may be a tyrant, but he is simultaneously, like all North Koreans, a victim of the system he was born into, a system that he is mostly powerless to change. Unlike his father, he was far too young to have consciously maneuvered his way into power. Rather, he was selected, chosen to be his father's successor. And whether he wanted it or not, in such a society that combines filial piety with state terror, one is not allowed much choice in these or any other matters. We will probably not know for many years what has been going on behind closed doors in the capital since 2012. What led Jong-un to have his uncle and senior advisor, Jang Son-taek, executed in 2013? Or even if Jong-un was actually behind the purge? To what extent Jong-un is an autonomous actor, the evil dictator of yore? And to what extent he is the puppet of other, perhaps competing, forces? What we do know, because it is obvious to anyone who has visited the country and seen it with their own eyes in these years, is that in spite of the sanctions and the country's international pariah status, the effects of economic liberalization have been on display since Kim Jong-un came to power. From the beginning, when he gave his very first speech and asserted that our people will never have to tighten their belts again, development has been at the core of the new regime's domestic policy. Today, Pyongyang is living testament to this fact. With ambitious building projects, postmodern and neo-futuristic apartment blocks being erected on entirely new streets in the capital, the city is looking less like a bizarre, colorless joke and more like a proper East Asian 21st century capital. Then there are the Donju, those soldiers in the commercial front, the true pragmatists of contemporary DPRK. Unafraid to flaunt their wealth, they are the living emblems that show us the extent to which capitalism is well and truly alive in this ostensibly socialist land. These new dreamers of North Korea don't have revolution on their minds. Their dreams are wrapped up in business, deals, the attainment and sustenance of personal wealth. Their existence reveals the inevitable flaw that Kim Il-sung and his cohorts failed to discern when they were designing what to them seemed like their own unique form of socialism. The failure to do away with a class system. While making the surface gesture of doing away with the economic class system redolent of capitalism, they instead instituted a political class system, that of Songun. A class system that is just as rife with inequalities as the economic class system of capitalism. The new dreamers, Jongmadangers like Min, like Comrade Kim, are privileged to have been born into a level of political capital that affords them the ability to attain the economic capital they actually desire. And increasingly, those not born into the necessary classes of political privilege, but who are savvy enough, can buy their way into it via membership in the Workers' Party and other tokens of prestige and power. The Songbun system is thus diminishing in the evolution of a meritocracy that is but a slightly distorted mirror image of the elitist system at the heart of global neoliberalism. These dreamers are the ones who will mold this country into something that looks very different from what it has been. They have already started. They are the ones behind the lucrative building projects that are transforming the architecture, layout, and overall image of Pyongyang. Other cities have begun to follow suit. That the current leader is a peer, age-wise, makes it easier for them to identify with him, revealing a deep generational divide in the landscape. Perhaps they sense the gravity of the problem he has inherited, that there are no easy solutions. The recent spate of purges has largely targeted individuals from the older generation, his father's men, just as Kim Jong-il immediately got rid of his father's men. Beneath the ecstatic declarations of love for the leader espoused by North Koreans publicly, there is, as defectors tell us and as some of us have intuited in our first-hand encounters, a great diversity of opinion unvoiced, unvoiceable. It seems unlikely that Kim Jong-un and the power structure to which he is attached will go away anytime soon. And among the young elites of Pyongyang, there is a sense that they do not want him to. He enables them, and vice versa. Chapter 18. There are, of course, more recent events than the arduous march that have been seared into the Jiangmedang generation's collective patchwork of memory. In 2009, the government issued a disastrous currency reform. Citizens had less than a week to exchange their old yuan notes for the new yuan. Simultaneously, a draconian limit was placed on the amount of yuan that could be exchanged by each individual. As a result, many lost the bulk of their savings, particularly those whose wealth had been made trading on the illegal black markets from the arduous march up till then. So widespread was the discontent, with near riots erupting in several cities, that Kim Jong-il had to find a fall guy for the disaster. Pak Nam-ji, the country's 77-year-old finance chief, was blamed for the decision and executed on the charge of attempting to destroy the nation's fragile economy with the reform. Then there was the Shimwago, the scrutiny, a new purge that terrorized the entire country, orchestrated by Kim Jong-il but overseen by his brother-in-law, Chang Song-taek. It began with Sho Guan-hee, agricultural secretary of the Workers' Party, who was blamed for the famine. He was accused of being an American spy, a classic charge in show trials throughout the communist world, who had intentionally sabotaged the country's food supply to starve his compatriots. As punishment, he was stoned to death by a whipped-up mob in a Pyongyang stadium in 1997. The evidence against Sho was scant. During 1 or 2 years of the Korean War, there were blank spaces in his identity booklet, carried by all North Koreans to document their peregrinations from year to year. It was during this undocumented period, it was asserted, that Sho was brought to the United States and trained to become a spy. Naturally, almost everyone who was alive during the war years had blank entries in their identity booklets. The country was plunged into chaos, and it was impossible for any government entity to keep track of people. Any cadre that had been alive during the 3 years of the Korean War was now a target. The real purpose of the Shimwago, actually, was to get rid of all those who had been loyal to Kim Il-sung, rather than Kim Jong-il, in the years following the great leader's death. Ironically, as factional infighting took over, the purges even reached into the upper echelons of Kim Jong-il's own OGD, the powerful force field he had developed early on as a tool for wresting power away from his father. During the 3 years that the Shimwago lasted, around 20,000 cadres and their families were sent to concentration camps or executed on trumped-up charges. Among the elites in Pyongyang, Chiang Song-taek is still remembered as the main architect of the purge. It was Chiang who saw to it that his enemies in the OGD were brutally tortured to death. Was Chiang Song-taek's subsequent execution under Kim Jong-un plotted by those still alive and in power with revenge on their minds? According to the charges, Chiang's purging was attributed to a range of confusing and contradictory factors. Power-hungry factionalist, corrupt official, corrupter of the youth, womanizer, bribe acceptor. Nobody knows for sure why Chiang was purged. Those who do know won't talk about it. Outsiders speculate that Chiang wanted to open the country up to Chinese-style economic reforms, a process that Kim Jong-un ultimately rejected. Others have said that it's the exact opposite, that Chiang was a hardliner who tried to guide Jong-un away from such liberalization. Still others say that the plotting against him could more likely be attributed to the power of his position, which gave him and his cronies a monopoly on all the lucrative business deals brokered by the regime, blocking the way for other powerful cadres who desired a larger piece of the pie. These days, everything is about money, and often nakedly so. Money flows, and the direction it goes is up, up, up. It climbs a ladder via loyalty dues that reaches the big man at the top, his closest family and friends. And in a land that is so heavily sanctioned by the outside world, nearly every means of making money is an illicit enterprise. The whole country begins to resemble a huge underground crime syndicate, operating beneath the blanket of socialism with a rather backward S. But is this system really so corrupt? So separate from our own market-based economics in the 21st century, in which literally everything and anything is bought, sold, exchanged at every minute of every hour? Or is this yet another way in which our world has once again infringed upon theirs, forever altering it? As the Frankfurt School philosophers asserted, it is in capital's nature to expand and expand and expand until it has no place left to go, at which point it will allegedly self-combust. More recently, Slavoj Žižek has pointed to the irreconcilable qualities of capitalism and democracy, noting with typical irony that authoritarian capitalism represents a much more sensible compatibility. Žižek attributes the invention of authoritarian capitalism to Singapore's former Prime Minister Lee Kuan Yew. China was able to adapt it in the 1980s, and in doing so, became a global superpower, while remaining, in name, a communist state. In actuality, it is perhaps the foremost example of what the Slovenian philosopher calls an authoritarian capitalist state. Market-based economics has no problem accommodating local religions, cultures, or traditions, writes Žižek. It is easily reconciled with the primacy of an authoritarian state. No longer wedded to Western cultural values, it is arguably divorced from them. Critically reinterpreted, many of the ideas that Westerners hold dear, egalitarianism, fundamental rights, a generous and universal welfare state, can be deployed as weapons against capitalism. Still, the Donju are savvy enough to perceive that isolationism, whether imposed from the outside via sanctions or from above in the form of xenophobic ultranationalism, and the restriction of outside information from entering the country, is not good for business. In the globalized 21st century, capital does not respect borders. The Donju, and virtually everyone else interested in making money in North Korea, which is to say, everyone, want the doors open. But it is not easy to find trading partners intrigued by the prospect of doing business with what the world regards as a rogue state. A partner willing to risk jail time, devastating fines, and overall ruin in violating sanctions. Are the sanctions effective? Not in any discernible sense. More than 70 years into it, the time is well past for any mass uprising that would unseat the current regime. Rather, citizens are more likely to blame all economic woes on the sanctions, giving them one more reason to despise the United States. Each time new sanctions are imposed, the government and the people living under them have sought and found new ways for getting around them. With each passing year, the per capita income continues to rise. For us, on the outside, the difficulty with North Korea is that there is no precedent, no pre-existing model we might look to politically as a guide for redeploying old strategies. Our politicians lack originality when it comes to creating new solutions. New ideas will not come about until someone is willing to look very hard at what this country, fundamentally and undauntingly, is. North Koreans, of course, realize this, which is why, in spite of all the hardships, they carry themselves with a certain gloat. I keep thinking of a work of calligraphy I saw at the Korean Art Gallery. I was able to read it with my new childlike comprehension of the language. Just two words, in elegant script. Our way. That way must be understood. And it must be taken seriously. Because whether anyone likes it or not, it is quite literally the only way forward. Chapter 19. Why don't you open up a French restaurant in Pyongyang? Min asks Alexander as we cruise down the bumpy highway. We drive past peasants at backbending labor in soppy rice fields on our way back to the city. We're talking about all the new restaurants that have opened in recent years. Alec is even toying with the idea of publishing a Pyongyang restaurant guide for expats and tourists. Min smells a new business venture in the mix. It doesn't cost a lot of money to open up a restaurant in Pyongyang, Min hints. Sure. How about a fusion restaurant? Kimchi baguette, we'll call it. Kimchi baguette, Min squeals. I love it. Will you come eat there if I open one? Of course, Min shouts excitedly. Better yet, we could be partners. Let's open a restaurant together. French food is rather expensive to make, Alexander protests. It would cost a lot to import all the ingredients. Alexander smiles and stares out the window. A village comprising a makeshift assortment of 3- and 4-story apartment buildings, no electricity, followed by a row of dilapidated farm huts. Min excitedly urges Alexander on. Exotic cuisines are now all the rage in Pyongyang, she insists. Just last month, a new Italian place opened, and the ingredients won't cost all that much to import. They can be gotten from China. Do you really think there's a market here for high-end French cuisine? Asks Alexander, generally curious. That's why you need me, replies Min, with bright confidence. I know all the right people. Wah lays on the horn, and we scream past the sole vehicular traffic on the highway. An old man, in tattered army fatigues, leading an ox cart piled high with cement bricks. Part 5. The Atrocity Exhibition. Chapter 20. By our second week, a workday routine has been established. In the morning, we saunter down to one of the hotel's 3 restaurants for a breakfast of toast, eggs, and instant coffee, though we are also free to help ourselves to the more elaborate buffet intended for Chinese guests, replete with sliced bean curd, cucumbers, rice, and porridge. Then down to the lobby, meeting Ro and a constantly late Min for the crosstown commute to Kim Hyong-jik University for 2 hours of lessons. Afternoons are more eclectic, centered on a list of activities and excursions that Alexander and I agreed upon with Alec. Given the duration of our stay, some afternoons sightseeing is sidelined by more mundane quotidian tasks, like shopping and laundry. We are kept so busy that we have little time at night for homework. As slow as the time seems to pass here, we are left each night to wonder where it is all gone. Given Alec's long-term business interests and acquaintanceship with Min and Comrade Kim, who joins us for dinner every few days, we are made to feel less like tourists, more like illustrious guests with a private chauffeur. The longer we stay, the more at home we feel in this strange place, the less strange it feels. At lunch, we slurp our cold noodles and chat with Min and Ro with a relaxed air of conviviality, punctuated by eruptions of laughter. By contrast, on those occasions when other foreign tour groups will appear in the restaurant, their guides and drivers nearly always sit at a separate table, seeming bored with their charges. Weekends, we usually take day trips outside of Pyongyang. Today's Saturday, so we'll take a drive out to neighboring South Hwanghae Province, which occupies the southwestern corner of the country. Our first stop, rural Sinchon County, home of the Sinchon Museum of American War Atrocities. I've been wanting to visit the museum for years, but it is rarely put on group itineraries. It's considered one of the more sensitive sites, a polite way of saying that its contents are actually rather incendiary. The Sinchon Museum is intended more for domestic rather than international propaganda purposes. Virtually every North Korean visits the museum at least once on mandatory educational pilgrimages. After the 3-hour ride along the potholed highway through depressed Bucalia, our van pulls into the empty parking lot.
"You know what kind of place this is, right?"
Min asks, a hint of warning in her voice as we climb out of our metallic, air-conditioned box on wheels. Elevated on a royal slope above the parking lot, the museum glistens beneath the scorching late July sun. The guide, in yellow chosenote, is already making her way down the sidewalk toward us. Above the entrance, a large propaganda slogan has been inscribed in gold lettering. Alec teasingly asks if my Korean is good enough yet to read it. His is: "Do not forget the lesson of blood on the ground of Sinchon." After we exchange greetings with the guide, our tour commences as we make our way up the hill. Halfway up, we pause before two elevated mounds, familiar to anyone who has visited a Goryeo Dynasty-era imperial tomb, such as that of King Kongmin outside of Kaesong. These, however, are not the tombs of an emperor and his wife. One, we are told, contains the remains of 100 women who died in the slaughter that took place here. The other, the remains of 100 children. To the left of the museum building stand two warehouses, so nondescript that I hadn't noticed them a moment before. These, we are told, are the buildings in which the victims were murdered by the American capitalists. The museum opened just 5 years after the Korean War armistice, on March 26, 1958. It was rebuilt in 2015 on the orders of Kim Jong-un, who instructed that it be made more comfortable for Korean visitors. Previously, the museum space was located at a greater distance from the warehouses where the victims had been killed. Now, they were located side by side, presumably to strengthen the dramatic impact of the horrors contained in each of the buildings. At the time the war broke out, Sinchon was a regional transportation hub and therefore a strategic point militarily. To get to Pyongyang or Haechu, the provincial capital, you had to pass through. In the early days of the Korean War, the town was captured by the U.S. military. For the 52 days they occupied the area, from October 17th to December 7th, 1950, when they were driven out by the advancing Chinese troops, they committed numerous mass murders and atrocities, aimed chiefly at local civilians, that amounted to nothing less than a total Holocaust. At least, this is the story the museum is here to tell. It has been erected on the locale where many of these crimes against humanity allegedly took place. The museum is not merely a commemorative site, but a vivid, stomach-churning evocation, replete with wax dummies, fake blood, and a piped-in soundscape of screaming children, of the savage butchery and malicious nature that signify American imperialism. We proceed along a chronology of brutality. The U.S. soldiers launched their adventure, our guide relays, by gathering 900 local residents into an air raid shelter. Through the air ducts, they poured gasoline and then incinerated the victims. "All of them were innocent civilians, mostly women and children," she somberly intones. This was followed by the massacre of October 20th, when 520 people were placed inside yet another air raid shelter, in which the devious Americans had planted dynamite. They locked the doors and detonated it. Our guide takes great relish in elucidating all the gory details. Min takes less delight in interpreting, rendering the English translation in an affectless monotone of a description of human flesh left hanging from the walls of the shelter. I'm reminded of Eden, 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 Pierre Guyot's anti-novel, with its overwrought and crude incantations of sadistic violence, rape, and mass murder, meant to evoke the horrors of the Algerian War. Indeed, with its lack of historical contextualization and refutation of any causal factors that might bolster the verisimilitude of what is displayed, even the blurred black-and-white photographic documentation looks abstract, as though it could have been pulled from any number of the past century's mass slaughters. The museum, like Guyot's book, is a collection of fragments of violence. Both works are essentially pornographic. The action shifts to a nearby hot springs resort, commandeered by U.S. soldiers as a barracks. There, our guide explains, they dragged local women, raped them, and then threw them into the hot springs and tossed in grenades to cover up their crimes. Becoming animated, the museum guide bemoans these American lunatics who tortured women by cutting off their breasts and inserting sticks in their vaginas. She nearly spits on the floor. And these Americans preach about human rights and boast that they enjoy the utmost of civilizations. When not busy raping and murdering women at the hot springs, the soldiers were occupied with the project of slaughtering an additional 1,200 locals. This they accomplished with the help of vicious attack dogs, or by burning them to death. It is not specified whether these two methods were employed simultaneously or alternately. It is fruitless to ask, as rationality does not play much of a role in this type of narrative construction. 12 miles north of Sinchon, a bridge was barricaded by the U.S. Army. Every civilian approaching that day, hoping to cross, was instead murdered. At another bridge, the soldiers took sadistic pleasure in tying sacks filled with rocks to the feet of local peasants and tossing them off to drown in the deep river below. The few who were lucky enough to survive and managed to swim up to the surface didn't meet a happy end. They were shot at by the evil Yankees above to ensure not a single survivor was left. These scenes are enacted by lifelike mannequins, ugly American soldiers with hooked noses. One can't help but think of the depiction of Jews in Nazi Germany propaganda, and malevolent grins. Others are illustrated in large, muralesque wall paintings. Over speakers, a soundtrack of screaming children and symphonic music. Piles of bodies forming mass graves in grainy photographs. Every few years, a new mass grave will be discovered in the vicinity, necessitating the museum's constant expansion. Some of the skeletons unearthed were scratching the ground, trying to climb to the surface as they suffocated. In one of these mass graves, they found the remains of a 9-month-old fetus in one of the bodies, says the guide. So you can tell these Americans even killed pregnant women. I wonder what's going through Min's mind as she's forced to interpret. Whether she believes all these things. Whether she is sickened by them. What kind of detachment her flat, emotionless transcription is rooted in. Surely she has a different relationship to history, to the history that is so key in fomenting North Korean national identity, having grown up thousands of miles away. Alec and Alexander and I are careful to remain silent, even avoid glancing at one another, throughout the tour. In the past, it has not been unheard of for tourists to react in anger, even argue with the museum guides over the veracity of such outlandish claims. This is why tourists are rarely brought here. It is something that has to be requested. Alec breaks protocol to point out a detail in a particularly gruesome, corpse-strewn photo, and begins to whisper something in my ear. Min uncharacteristically reacts in anger, halting her hate speech translation to remind us, "It was you who wanted to come here," before huffing off to the next room. Later, when she notices me filming her on my phone as she is interpreting, she asks me to stop. Understatement has never been considered a virtue in the North Korean propaganda machinery. Overwhelmed by disbelief, I ask the guide to clarify whether all of these crimes actually took place here in Sinchon, or if this museum is meant to commemorate atrocities that had taken place throughout Korea during the war.
The museum documents only the crimes that took place here, she responds,
before quickly adding, though more atrocities were committed all over Korea. Of course. We are led into yet another room with the sound of screaming children at full blast. Are school children also brought to this museum? I am inspired to ask.
Yes, replies the guide proudly. And after seeing the exhibition, the children say, the U.S. imperialists are not human. They are wolves.
In the hallway, we pass by a large propaganda banner. Alec translates, don't forget the U.S. imperialist wolves. As November 1950 drew to a close, the American imperialist wolves realized that the sheep had outnumbered them. They would have to flee as soon as possible. But before they did, they committed a final genocide. To stop the seeds of communism from growing, they gathered up as many women and children as they could find, separated them in two storehouses, poured in gasoline, and burned them alive. Only three children survived. One, we are told, now works here at the museum. But they were not left orphaned, despite the tragedy. They had their new father, the state, the great leader Kim Il-sung, to look after them. As we move on in the display, the exhibition segues from scenes of mass brutality to showcasing acts of barbarity carried out against individuals. In a mannequinized reenactment, a female resistance leader is held down by one U.S. soldier while another drives a nail into her skull. The guide comments, "You can see the atrociousness of the American imperialists who enjoyed torturing and killing people in an atrocious way while they were here." A young adolescent, the leader of the Communist Student Union, was murdered for being a model student, among other transgressions. A model hero worker met his end by being torn apart, with each side of his limbs tied to separate ox carts run in opposite directions. The principal of an elementary school had his head chopped off with a hatchet. Another woman was tied to a tree, had her breast cut off, and was then burned to death.
It's the exact same way they treated the Indians, our guide notes. The United States is still carrying out war exercises in an attempt to invade our country, she continues.
Then, with the open-handed gesture with which you are permitted to acknowledge a portrait of one of the leaders, pointing is forbidden, the guide draws our attention to a large photograph of Kim Jong-un, whose wise leadership will prevent that from ever happening. Nearing the end of the exhibitions, the guide's delivery rises to an emotional peak, her voice quivering wildly.
We Korean people won't forget the crimes that these animal-like people committed on our land. We will make them pay for all the blood they spilled.
Outside, we make our way down the sidewalk toward the two warehouses. Perched on a hill, we are afforded a glimpse over the town of Sinchon. I attempt to take a photograph of the townscape, but a plainclothes male guard suddenly approaches and demands I lower my camera. The first storehouse is a replica of the one in which the original genocide by fire was alleged to have taken place. Inside, the guide points to air ducts in the ceiling where the gasoline was poured in. The second building is one of the actual warehouses where the children were burned alive. An elderly gentleman with jet black hair and a khaki worker's uniform appears. I've never seen anyone with dyed hair in North Korea before, but it's hard for me to believe that someone could make it to that age without a single sprout of gray, especially considering what he is alleged to have experienced. He is, we are told, one of the three children who survived that day. His speech further embellishes the wickedness committed by the American devils. They passed out cups of water and encouraged the children to drink, he tells us, but the water turned out to be gasoline. Luckily, he was situated in one of the far corners of the storeroom and passed out early because of the cold, so his life was spared. The Americans, he says, are animals wearing the masks of human beings. Even though time has passed, the flames of anger still burn in my heart. As we exit the storehouse, a group of about 2 dozen workers is outside, a factory work unit on an educational field excursion, patiently waiting for us to finish so that they might have their turn.
I wonder what they're thinking after seeing all that, and now having to look at us, whispers Alexander.
I thought that would be the last of it, but then there is a third storehouse, home of yet another burning atrocity. But by now I am so emotionally exhausted by the contents and overwhelmed with the theatricality of the staging that I have lost track of the narrative. Min points to a piece of graffiti that was scratched into the wall at the last moment. "Long live the Workers' Party of Korea," wrote the dying martyr. Before bidding us adieu, the museum guide makes her conclusive speech. "Please go back to your countries and spread word of the terrible atrocities suffered by our people. The Koreans never wanted a war. We are the most peace-loving people in the entire world." Then, without a pause, "We will never forget what the American imperialists did to us. One day, we will have our revenge." Chapter 21. After that, we are hardly in the mood for revelry. But after much cajoling by Alec and Alexander, Min announces on the way back to Pyongyang that she was granted permission to take us to the Friendship Club for the Saturday night soiree. A big deal, since tourists typically aren't allowed inside this part of Pyongyang, the diplomatic quarter where most foreign residents are housed. Save for the employees of the embassies and missions stationed there, North Koreans cannot go past the guarded entrance either. They will have to drop us off at dinner time and pick us up at 11 p.m. I feel like a teenager again. Alexander is excited to get away from our minders, but he also has ulterior motives. He might not be opening kimchi baguette anytime soon, but he does have a fantasy of working here someday. Neither Alec nor I can determine what his ultimate goal is. He's clearly obsessed with this place. But then so are we. But whereas Alec and I are mainly just curious to see what life inside the compound looks like, Alexander is out to network and make contacts. He's already started, even before the trip. In Paris, he managed to get introduced to the head of France's recently opened consular service. This is why Alexander really bought the phone. He was able to call ahead and secure a personal invitation to tonight's festivities. Munsudong Diplomatic Quarter is in East Pyongyang, not far from our university. The Friendship Club is situated in a small 2-story house. It contains a restaurant and small bar, with a billiards table on the ground floor, while upstairs there is a makeshift disco, with a larger bar as well as a karaoke sal. A sort of diluted successor of the Random Access Club, opened by aid workers in the famine years of the 1990s. At a time when there was a veritable lack of leisure options in the city. The ironically named Random Access Club, access being rather elusive in North Korea, gained notoriety for its Friday and Saturday parties, though perhaps not reaching the level of decadence attained by Kim Jong-il's parties in the early 1980s. In an interview about her years as a kidnapped member of Jong-il's inner circle in Pyongyang, actress Choi Yoon-hee revealed that fawning over and toasting the dear leader were key components of the evening. Jong-il himself would often sit at a distance and direct the evening's proceedings, instructing partygoers when and what to drink, which games to play, with whom each should dance. Activities that would get a normal citizen shot were freely indulged in. Western disco and South Korean pop songs danced to. Expensive liquor, including Kim's favorite, Hennessy Cognac, consumed in staggering abundance. Teenage girls from Jong-il's personal joy division were on hand, to provide sexual favors for the male guests. If you were one of Zhang Il's people, these parties were mandatory to attend. They played a key role in the younger Kim's wrenching of power out of his father's hands. Promotions and demotions could be issued on the spot, as well as, on at least one occasion, an execution. The victim, the wife of an elite, had written an indiscreet tell-all letter to Kim Il-sung, who was in the dark about such fêtes, complaining of the son's decadent ways. Instead of reaching its intended recipient, the letter fell into Zhang Il's hands. That night, he announced to all in attendance the instantaneous verdict and death sentence, which was to be carried out immediately. Upon hearing the announcement, the husband of the condemned rose and implored Zhang Il to allow him to carry out the execution personally. Zhang Il consented, handing him the gun. By comparison, the Random Access Club gatherings of the subsequent decade were a comparatively mild affair and solely reserved for the expatriate diplomats and aid workers living in Pyongyang, as well as the occasional visitor. But the party came to an end in 2012 when a couple of French NGO workers threw a so-called workers' party. Guests came dressed in Vinalon Mao suits and proceeded to drunkenly slander the dear leadership as the evening's festivities wore on. Naturally, the place was bugged, and the offensive shenanigans duly reported to the authorities. The responsible NGO workers had their visas revoked and were put on the next plane to Beijing. The Random Access Club was shuttered for good. We arrive for dinner around 8 p.m. Early, it turns out. The place is deserted. The waitress leads us into the restaurant, addressing us with a flawless American accent. "Welcome to the Friendship Club," she beams. "We haven't seen you around here before. Where are you from?" When she hears that I'm American, she gives a visible start, followed by an embarrassed smile. "Well, we don't really get very many Americans around here. Shall I give you a minute to look at the menu?" She scatters off to the kitchen, no doubt to report our presence to her Baobab superiors. We take advantage of the a la carte offerings to indulge in some Western food. After finishing our pizza, hamburger steaks, and fries, we order ice cream for dessert. As we're finishing, Alexander hears French-speaking voices emerging from the downstairs bar, which is starting to fill up. He excuses himself and vanishes. After settling the bill, Alec and I follow after him. In the bar, it's the United Nations of Pyongyang. The room is populated with mostly middle-aged career diplomat types and their spouses from across Europe and a few Southeast Asians, plus a smattering of 30-somethings modeling the khaki, denim, and polo shirts connoting the international aid worker. Loosened ties and casual evening wear abound in this scene of cocktail hour conviviality. At the center of it all, a beautiful young Korean woman, exquisitely dressed, holds court. She's the head boss here, someone pointedly whispers. She darts back and forth behind the bar, greeting all comers, keeping the drinks flowing alongside the conversation. Recognizing the three newbies in her midst, she flows through the crowd and introduces herself to each of us whenever our scattered conversations reach an opportune pause. Throughout the course of the evening, Ms. Lee will ask us each our name, our nationality, our job, where we're staying, and what we're doing here. And in that precise order, I notice she's wearing no Kim badge, probably as a tool for encouraging drunken indiscretions. She introduces me to a tall, handsome young man working for the Swedish embassy. "It's his last month here with us in Pyongyang," Ms. Lee bats her eyelashes, honey-pottishly. "We're going to be so sad to see him go." He politely shakes my hand. "Did I register with the embassy prior to my arrival?" "Yes, I sent an email a month ago." "Let me know if there's anything I can do for you while you're here." He gives me his card and then skittishly excuses himself. Like nearly all the Western embassies here, the Swedish mission is small, just two staff members. Since the U.S. has no embassy in the DPRK, Sweden handles the concerns of U.S. citizens in the country, which means it is forced to play middleman whenever an American tourist is arrested and detained. Everyone we meet is taken aback by our presence. Mine, in particular. It is an anomaly enough in itself that non-Chinese foreign students have been granted permission to study here. But an American? That's unheard of. I am warned constantly to be careful. I breezily dismiss all words of caution. I don't plan on stealing any propaganda banners while I'm in town, I tell them. Or proselytizing. Nobody laughs at my funny joke. Well, we don't know for sure what really happened, is the common response when the case of Otto Warmbier inevitably comes up, as though a consensus had been secretly reached not to trust any versions of the story promulgated in the media. Upstairs in the disco, 90s dance music plays, interspersed with drunken interpretations of pop classics on the karaoke machine. We're nearing our scheduled pickup time. Too early, we realize, as many new guests are only now arriving to merge with the crowd of some 24. We try to make the most of what time we have left, gleaning some sense of what expat life is like here. Alec and I make our way to the front door, passing Alexander, who is bidding adieu to a vaguely hippie-ish Italian 40-something with plaited hair, an engineer from a development-oriented NGO. Be careful what you say, she tells him, because you never know when they are listening. Even when they are not listening, they often know things, so it is always best to be honest. They are suspicious of us, of all foreigners. They think we are here because we want to change the system. But the Korean people are happy with the way things are. They don't want it to change. She shrugs her shoulders. And they do have a right to live as they see fit. Earlier, a secretarial staff member from the German embassy had a far more cynical take on things. You are studying here? She said to me, almost accusingly. Just so you know, for them it's not really about cultural exchange. They're just interested in the money. How much are you paying for this anyway? Since we're both Berliners, I asked her about the youth hostel next door to the DPRK embassy in central Berlin. DPRK diplomatic missions are tasked not only with coming up with their own funding, but with generating income to send the regime back home. As such, DPRK embassy staff are believed to have been involved with all sorts of business ventures, of both the legal and illegal varieties. Diplomatic immunity comes in handy here. Overseas ambassadors have been caught smuggling everything from rhinoceros horn to crystal meth. Since the fall of communist Europe and the reunification of Germany, the sprawling DPRK embassy in the former East Berlin was needlessly vast for its few staff and family members. In 2008, the larger of its two buildings was leased to a well-known hostel. Backpackers staying there might notice the DPRK embassy next door, with its display case out front, featuring a revolving exhibition of photographs of the Kims giving on-the-spot guidance, but otherwise have no idea where their money is actually going. We Germans have been very angry with them about that. She shrugged. They owe us 2 million euros in back taxes on that hostel, which, of course, they will never pay. Word quickly spreads in the tiny expat community as to our presence in Pyongyang. When we bump into a Western stranger at a coffee shop or restaurant, we're usually met with something along the lines of, "Oh, yes, you're the one studying Korean at Kim Hyang-jik University. Now are you the Australian, the French, or the American?" Gossip travels fast when there are so few competing distractions. For as exciting as this all is for us the first couple weeks, as we settle in, I begin to realize that for long-term foreign residents, boredom is more or less the unifying force. The following week, we are invited to a Stammtisch, organized by the German embassy in the communal dining area of the building shared by Germany, Sweden, and the UK. The atmosphere is markedly different from the Friendship Club. For one thing, no Koreans are present. The spouses of the embassy employees take turns tending bar, spooning out potato salad, and distributing sausages and slices of brown bread. Alexander and I arrive alone at the Stammtisch. Our attendance at these events clearly makes Min and Ro somewhat uncomfortable. Or perhaps envious, since Munso Dong is one of the few places we can go where they're not allowed. Alec elects to stay behind to have dinner with them and Comrade Kim. They need to talk business anyway. Tongil Tours has several more tours planned in the coming months.